This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
You don't know how happy it makes me feel to stand backstage to hear people gasping, whistling, and cheering, to hear the names of the writers who will be visiting in the new season. I have many reasons to be happy to be here right now for the Lannan Foundation, who have become and are my second family, because there are, you know, mortal problems in my first and birth family. And I wanted very much to be here with you. Annie Prue it's an honor for me to introduce her. And, you know, the size of the house is, you know, just an indication of how little introduction she needs. When we last spoke publicly, it was at a discussion of Brokeback Mountain before the film had opened, and I began by saying that the film was so emotional that if people chose to leave and didn't want to hear a conversation to alter or distort their feeling, that they should, without embarrassment. And people said, "What are you talking about?" And then for weeks afterwards, I kept getting letters saying, "I loved it so much, but I was so emotionally overwhelmed." Now, that condition of emotional overwhelm, I don't think is the result of the movie. It's the result of the writing of Annie Prue. When I first encountered her writing, it was because it had won my favorite award. That was the Faulkner Award for Fiction. They would discover people before they'd been discovered. Cormac McCarthy had won a Faulkner Award. Thomas Pynchon won the Faulkner Award with his very first book. And even the books you've never heard of, like a book called Powdered Eggs by Charles Simmons, it's worth finding. You know, the Faulkner is a good indicator, and Annie Prue was the first woman to win the Faulkner Award. But she deserves every award there is. I mean, I think that she would solve the problem of awards in America if only they would just face it, that this is an absolutely major American writer whose concerns with history, American space, the American people, the brokenhearted, our lostness, the way in which environment and weather affect us and shape us and change us, the way in which, you know, even when very young, she studied the new history, the kind that Fernand Braudel does, that talks about the history as being the history of everyday people. As she said, that training in history was superb for a novelist, and you can see in the vaster books like Accordion Crimes the hugeness of the horizon. She does for life, and in the later books, American Life, what Carl Sandburg wanted to do, you know, that is to say, to celebrate the whole damn thing. But she's not soppy. In fact, the opposite. She's ornery, and she, you know, she's, they say about her, she's a stubborn cuss. And I like that about her. There's nothing that she does. You know, she's right now angry at the way The New Yorker edits, and she says, "I wanted this to be the last time." But luckily, this week in The New Yorker, there's a long story, and I think one of her best. It's from this book that is coming out in October, Fine Just the Way It Is. Although you can't see the cover, it's a perfect Annie Prue title because it's graffiti written, and it's pointing to a photograph of an absolutely desolate shack, Fine Just the Way It Is. And, you know, the way in which Americans embrace conditions that need to be changed because they're fine just the way they are. You know, this is, you know, in a sense, the war against the private personality that her work has waged. You know, this is the third book of with Wyoming stories, but the people of Wyoming are none too happy with her. I think a great artist makes everyone unhappy. Art shakes us up. It's there to reflect our misery. We are, you know, the person who said, echoing Chekhov, art is about how things go wrong. Today we're going to hear one of the most powerful stories about things going wrong and about how going wrong is an essential part of life. That is to say, we were born to go wrong, and in our past is our future. We're about to go very wrong again in many, many ways. I had some luck today, one of the characters in her most recent story says, and by this he means bad luck. I welcome Annie Prue.
Thank you all so much for coming. I haven't been in the Lenzik since early in March when I was here to hear Michael talk with Bruce Weigel and Brian Turner, the war poets. And I spent the winter in this town and came to the Lenzik often and grew to appreciate the Lannan Institute more than ever. And the work they do is known to every writer in the country, as is Michael Silverblatt, the prince of them all. I also learned that this is probably the finest audience in North America. Smart, sophisticated, well-educated, and with a little bit of cowboy. I'm going to read tonight the story Them Old Cowboy Songs. I've cut quite a bit out of sentences here and there so we fit into the time. There's a belief that pioneers come into the country, homesteaded, lived tough, raised a shoeless brood, and founded ranch dynasties. And some did. But many more had short runs and were quickly forgotten. Archie and Rose, 1885. Archie and Rose McLaverty staked out a homestead where the little weed comes rattling down from the Sierra Madre. Archie's natural decoration was in his red cheeks and the springy waves of auburn hair that seemed charged with voltage. He usually lied about his age to anyone who asked. He was not 21, but 16. The first summer they lived in a tent while Archie worked on a small cabin. It took him a month of rounding up stray cows for bunk peck before he could afford two glass windows. The cabin was snug, built with 8-foot squared off logs, a size Archie could handle with a little help from their only neighbor, Tom Ackler, a leathery prospector with a summer shack up on the mountain. They chinked the cabin with heavy yellow clay. Archie dragged a huge flat stone to the house for their doorstep, and it was pleasant to sit in the cool of the evening with their feet on the stone and watch the deer come down to drink, and just before darkness to see the herons flying upstream, their color matching the sky so closely they might have been flues of wind. Archie sawed wood while Rose split kindling until they had 4 cords stacked high against the cabin, the pile immediately tenanted by a weasel. "He'll keep the mice down," said Rose. "Yeah, if the bastard don't bite somebody," said Archie, flexing his right forefinger. A faint brogue flavored his sentences, for he had been conceived in Ireland, born in 1868 in Dakota Territory of parents arrived from Bantry Bay, his father to spike ties for the Union Pacific Railroad. His mother's death from cholera when he was 7 was followed a few weeks later by that of his father, who had guzzled an entire bottle of strychnine lace patent medicine guaranteed to ward off cholera and measles if taken in teaspoon quantities. The family wipeout removed the Irish influence. Mrs. Sarah Peck, a warm-hearted Missouri Methodist widow, raised the young orphan to the great resentment of her son, Bunk. A parade of saddle bums drifted through the Peck bunkhouse, and from an early age, Archie listened to the songs they sang. He was a quick study for a tune, had a memory for rhymes, verses, and intonations. When Mrs. Peck went to the land of no breakfast forever, caught in a grass conflagration she started while singeing slaughtered chickens, Archie was 14 and Bunk in his early 20s. Without Mrs. Peck as a buffer, the relationship became one of hired hand and boss. There had never been any sense of kinship, fictive or otherwise, between them. Especially did Bunk Peck resent the $100 his mother left Archie in her will. Everyone in the sparsely settled country was noted for some salty dog quirk or talent. Archie McLaverty had a singing voice that once heard was never forgotten. It was a straight, hard voice, the words falling out halfway between a shout and a song. Sad and flat and without ornamentation, it expressed things felt but unsayable. He sang plain and square cut. Brandy's brandy any way you mix it, a Texan's a Texan any way you fix it. And the listeners laughed at the droll way he rolled out fix it, the words surely meaning castration. He could sing every song, Go Long, Blue Dog, and When the Green Grass Comes, Don't Pull Off My Boots, and 2 quarts of whiskey, and on all male roundup nights he had endless verses of The Stinkin' Cow, The Buckskin Shirt, and Cousin Harry. He courted Roe singing Never Marry No Good for Nothing Boy, the boy understood to be himself, the good for nothing, a disclaimer. Later, with winks and innuendo, he sang, Little girl, for safety, you better get branded. Archie, advised by an ex-homesteader working for Bunk Peck, used his inheritance from Mrs. Peck to buy 80 acres of private land. Since he had never expected anything from Mrs. Peck, buying the land with a surprise legacy seemed like getting it for free, and it was immediately theirs with no strings attached. Archie, thrilled to be a landowner, told Rose he had to sing the meets and bounds. He started on the southwest corner and headed east. There was something he reckoned had to be done. Rose walked along with him at the beginning and even tried to sing with him, but got out of breath from walking so fast and singing at the same time. Nor did she know the words to many of his songs. Archie kept going. It took him hours. Late in the afternoon, he was on the west line, drawing near and still singing, though his voice was raspy, and we'll go downtown and we'll buy some shirts. And slouching down the slope the last 100 feet in the evening dusk, so worn of voice she could hardly hear him breathily half chant, never had a nickel and I don't give a shit. There is no happiness like that of a young couple in a little house they have built themselves in a place of beauty and solitude. Archie had hammered together a table with sapling legs and 2 benches. At the evening meal, their faces lit by the yellow shine of the coal oil lamp, whose light threw wild shadows on the ceiling, their world seemed in order. Rose was not pretty, but warm-hearted and quick to laugh. She had grown up at the Jackrabbit stage station, the daughter of kettle-bellied sundown Miller, who dreamed of plunging steeds, but because of his bottle habit drove a freight wagon. The station was on a north-south trail connecting hardscrabble ranches with the blowout railroad town of Rawlins, after the Union Pacific line went through. Rose's mother was gray with some wasting disease that kept her to her bed, sinking slowly out of life. She wept over Rose's early marriage, but gave her a family treasure, a large silver spoon that had come across the Atlantic. The station master was the politically minded Robert F. Dorgan, affable and jowly, yearning to be appointed to a position of importance and seeing the station as a brief stop not only for freight wagons, but for himself. His second wife, Flora, stepmother to his daughter, Quida, went to Denver every winter with Quida, and so they became authorities on fashion and style. They were as close as a natural mother and daughter. In Denver, Mrs. Dorgan sought out important people who could help her husband climb to success. Many political men spent the winter in Denver, and one of them, Rufus Clatter, with connections to Washington, hinted there was a chance for Dorgan to be appointed as territorial surveyor. "Oh, I'm sure he knows a good deal about surveying," he said with a wink. "Considerable," she said, thinking that Dorgan could find some stripling surveyor to do the work for a few dollars. "I'll see what I can do," said Clatter, pressing heavily against her thigh, but tense to step back if she took offense. She allowed him a few seconds, smiled, and turned away. "Should such an appointment come to pass, you will find me very grateful." In the spring, back at the station, where her rings and metallic dress trim cast a golden aura, she bossed the local gossip, saying that Archie Laverty had ruined Rose, precipitating their youthful marriage. Rose, barely 14, but what could you expect from a girl with a drunkard father, an uncontrolled girl who'd had the run of the station, sassing rough drivers, and exchanging low repartee with bumpkin cowhands, among them Archie Laverty, a lowlife who sang vulgar songs. She whisked her hands together as though ridding them of filth. The other inhabitant of the station was an old bachelor, Harp Daft, the telegraph key operator. His face and neck formed a visor of scars, moles, wens, boils, and acne. One leg was shorter than the other, and his voice twanged with catarrh. His window faced the Dorgan house, and a black circle, which Rose knew to be a telescope, sometimes showed in it. Rose both admired and despised Quida Dorgan. She greedily took in every detail of the beautiful dresses, the fire opal brooch, satin shoes, and saucy hats so exquisitely out of place at the dusty station. But she knew that Miss Dainty had to wash out her bloody menstrual rags like every woman, although she tried to hide them by hanging them on the line at night or inside pillow slips. Beneath the silk skirt, she too had to put up with sopping pads torn from old sheets, the crusted edges chafing her thighs and pulling at the pubic hairs. At those times of the month, the animal smell seeped through Quida's perfumed defenses. Rose saw Mrs. Dorgan as an iron-bone, two-faced enemy, the public sweetness offset by private coarseness. She had seen the woman spit on the ground like a drover, had seen her scratch her crotch on the corner of the table when she thought no one was looking. Yet in her belief that she was a superior creature, Mrs. Dorgan never spoke to the Mealers or to the despicable bachelor pawing his telegraph key or, as he said, seeking out constellations. Every morning in the little cabin, Rose braided her straight brown hair, dabbed it with drops of lilac water from the blue bottle Archie had presented her on the day of their wedding, and wound it around her head in a coronet the way Quida Dorgan bound up her hair. At night, she let it fall loose, releasing the fragrance. She did not want to become like a homestead woman, skunky armpits and greasy hair yanked into a bun. She trimmed Archie's hair with a pair of embroidery scissors dropped in the dust by some stagecoach lady passenger at the station years before. But it was hard keeping clean. Quida Dorgan, for example, had little to do at the station but primp and flounce. But Rose in her cabin lifted heavy kettles, split kindling baked bread, scrubbed pots and hacked stone-filled ground for a garden, hauled water when Archie was not there. They were lucky their first winter that the river did not freeze. Her personal wash and the dishes and floor took four daily buckets of water lugged up from the little weed. She tried to keep Archie clean as well. He rode in from days of chasing Peck's cows or running wild horses on the desert, stubbled face, mosquito-bitten neck and grimed hands, cut, cracked nails and stinking feet. She pulled off his boots and washed his feet in the enamel dishpan, patting them dry with a clean feed sack towel. "If you had stockings, it wouldn't be so bad," she said. "If I could get me some knitting needles and yarn, I could make stockings." "Oh, Mrs. Peck made some once. Took about an hour before they was whole. There's no point to it, and they clamber around in your boots. Hell with stockings." Occasionally, neighbor Tom Ackler rode down for supper, sometimes with his yellow cat, Gold Dust, riding behind him on the saddle. While Tom talked, Gold Dust set to work to claw the weasel out of the woodpile. Rose liked that black-eyed, balding prospector and asked him about the gold earring in his left ear. "Used to sail the world, girlie. That's my port ear, and that ring tells them as knows that I've been east around Cape Horn. Been all over the world." He had a rich collection of stories of storms, violent willy-waws and southerly busters, of waterspouts and whales leaping like trout, icebergs and doldrums and enmeshing seaweed of wild times and distant ports. "How come you to leave the sailor boy life?" asked Rose. "No way to get rich, girlie, and this fellow wanted a snug harbor after the pitch and deck." Archie asked about maritime songs, and the next visit, Tom Ackler brought his concertina with him, and for hours, sea shanties and sailors' verses filled the cabin, Archie asking for a repeat of some, and often chiming in after a single hearing. "They say, old man, your horse will die, and they say so, and they hope so. Oh, poor old man, your horse will die. Oh, poor old man." Rose was an eager lover when Archie called "put your ass up like a whippoorwill," and an expert at shifting his occasional glum moods into pleased laughter. She seemed unaware that she lived in a time when love killed women. One summer evening, their bed spread on the floor among the chips and splinters in the half-finished cabin, they fell to kissing. Rose, in some kind of transport, began to bite her kisses, lickings and sharp nips along his neck, his shoulder, in the musky crevice between his arm and torso, his nipples, until she felt him shaking and looked up to see his eyes closed, tears in his lashes, face contorted in a grimace. "Oh, Archie, I didn't mean to hurt Archie." "You did not," he groaned. I never been, love. I can't hardly stand it." And he began to blubber. "Feel like I've been shot." Pulling her into his arms and rolling half over so that the salty tears and his saliva wet her embroidered shirt waist, calling her his little birdeen. And in that moment, she would have walked into a furnace for him. The second winter came on, and Bunk Peck laid off all the men, including Archie. Cowhands rode the circuit, moving from ranch to ranch, doing odd jobs in return for a place in the bunkhouse for three squares. Down on the little weed, Archie and Rose were ready for the cold. He had waited for good tracking snow and shot two elk and two deer in November when the weather chilled, swapping a share of the meat to Tom Ackler for his help, for it could take a lone man several days to pack a big elk out, with bears, lions, and wolves, coyotes, ravens, and eagles gorging on much of the unattended carcass as they could. Some mornings the wind stirred the snow into a scrim that bleached the mountains and made opaline dawn skies. Once the sun below the horizon threw savage red onto the bottom of the cloud that hung over Barrel Mountain, and Archie glanced up, saw Rose in the doorway, burning an unearthly color in the lurid glow. By spring, both of them were tired of elk and venison, tired of bumping into each other in the little cabin. Rose was pregnant. Her vitality seemed to have ebbed away, her good humor with it. Archie carried her water buckets from the river and swore he would dig a well in the coming summer. It was hot in the cabin, the April sun like a furnace door ajar. "You better get somebody knows about well digging," she said sourly, slapping the bowls on the table for the everlasting elk stew, nothing more than meat, water, and salt simmered to chewability, then reheated for days. "You remember how Mr. Town got killed when his well caved in and him in it?" "A well can cave in and I won't be in it," he said. "I got in mind not digging a deep killing well, but clearing out that little seep east of the meat house." He was short but muscular, and his shoulders had broadened, his chest filled out with the work. He started to sing, "Got to bring along my shovel if I got to dig a spring," ending with one of Tom's yo-heave hoes. But his jokey song did not soothe her irritation. An older woman would have seen that although they were little more than children, they were shifting out of the days of clutching love and into the long haul of married life. "Sick of deer meat," she said. "It's too bad you spent all your money on this land. You should have saved some out." "I still think it was the right way to do, but we sure need some chink. I'm riding to talk with Bunk in a few days. See, can I get hired on again?" He pulled on his dirty digging pants, still spattered with mud from the three-day job of the privy pit. "Don't get me no dinner. I'll dig until noon and come in for coffee. We got coffee yet?" Bunk Peck took pleasure in saying there was no job for him, nor was there anything at the other ranches. 8 or 10 Texas cowhands left over from last fall's Montana drive had stayed in the country and taken all the work. He tried to make a joke out of it for Rose, but the way he breathed through his teeth showed it wasn't funny. And after a few minutes, she said in a low voice, "At the station, they used to say they pay $100 a month up in Butte. Mrs. McLaverty, I wouldn't work in no mine. You married you, a cowboy. I'll ride over to Cheyenne Way and see what I can find, because there's big ranches over there and they probably need hands. I'll stop by Tom's place on my way and ask him to look in on you." The next day, he went on the drift. "We need the chink," she thought, "don't we?" Despite the strong April sun, there was still deep snow under the lodge poles and in north hollows around Tom Ackler's cabin. The place had a deserted feeling to it, something more than if Tom had gone off for the day. The cat, Gold Dust, came purring up onto the steps, but when Archie tried to pet her, tore his hand and with flattened ears raced into the pines. Inside the cabin, he found the stub of a pencil and wrote a note on the edge of an old newspaper and left it on the table. "Tom, I'm looking for work around Cheyenne. Check on Rose now and then, okay? Arch Laverty." In a saloon on a Cheyenne street packed with whiskey mills and gambling snaps, he heard that a rancher up around Lusk was looking for spring roundup hands. The whiskey bottles glittered as the swinging doors let in planks of light. Kellogg's Old Bourbon, Squirrel, McBrien's, G.G. Booze, Daydream, and a few sharp-cornered gin bottles. He bought the man a drink. "The thing was," said his informant, a big mustache smiler showing rotten nutcrackers, putting on the sideboards by wrapping his thumb and forefinger around the shot glass to gain another inch of fullness, "that although Carrick paid well and he didn't hardly lay off men in the fall, he would not hire a married man, claiming they had the bad habit of running off home to see the wife and kiddies, while Carrick's cows fell in mud holes and were victimized by mountain lions and rustlers, drifted down the draw and suffered the 100 other ills that could befall untended cattle." The bartender, half listening, sucked a draft of Wheatley's Spanish Pain Destroyer from a small bottle near the cash register. "Stomach," he said to no one, belching. Big Mustache knocked back his brimming shot of Squirrel and went on. "Yeah, Carrick's a foreigner from back east. The only thing counts to him is cows. He learned that fast when he come here back in the early days. Cows is the only thing. Grub's pretty poor, too. There ain't no chicken in the chicken soup." "Yeah, and no horse in the horseradish," said Archie, who'd heard all the feeble bunkhouse jokes. "Well, he rubbed some the wrong way. Most of them quit, what I done. Some law dog come out there once with his hand hovering over his shooter. I could see he was itching to dabble in gore. I felt it was like an awful good place to put behind me. But there's a few like Carrick's ways, and maybe you are one of them. Man rides for him, gets plenty practice night roping. You see, his herd grows like a son of a bitch, if you take my meaning. But I'll give you some advice. One of these days, there'll be trouble there. That's how come that law was nosing round." Archie rode up to Lusk through country as yellow and flat as an old newspaper and went to see Carrick. There was a big sign on the gate, "No married men." When the door rancher asked him, Archie lied himself single and said he had to fetch his gear, would be back in 6 days. "Five," said the kingpin, looking at him suspiciously. "Other fellows look for work, they carry their fixins. They don't have to go home and get it." Archie worked up some story about visiting Cheyenne and not knowing he'd been laid off until one of the old outfit's boys showed up and said they were all on a bum. Archie said he'd come straight to Carrick when he heard there might be a job. "Yeah, well, get going then. Roundup started 2 days ago." Back on the little weed with Rose, he half explained the situation, said she would not be able to send him letters or messages until he worked something out, said he had to get back to Lusk fast, would be gone for months. She'd better get her mother to come down from the station and stay and help with the baby expected in late September. "She can't stand to make that trip. You know how sick she is. Won't you come back for the baby?" Even in the few days he had been gone, he seemed changed. She touched him and sat very close, waiting for the familiar oneness to lock them together. If I can get loose, I will, but this is a real good job, good money. $55 a month, almost twice what Bunk Peck pays, and I'm going to save every nickel. And if she can't come down, you better get up there and be around women folk. Or maybe I can get Tom to bring you up July or August or sooner. He was fidgety, as though he wanted to leave that minute. He'd been around. His place was closed up, and I stopped there before, but I'll stop again on my way. Rose said that if she had to go to the station, early September was soon enough. She did not want to be where she would have to tend her sick mother, put up with her drunk father, see the telegraph man's face like an eroded cliff, suffer Mrs. Dorgan's supercilious comments about some people directed at Quita, but meant for Rose to hear. If you save everything, it'll come to $650, and we'll be rich, won't we? She asked in a mournful tone he chose not to notice. He spoke enthusiastically. And that's not counting what I can maybe pick up in wolf bounties, possible another 100, enough to get us started. Thinking horses, raise horses. Folks always need horses. I'll quit this feller's ranch after a year and get back here. How do I get news to you about the baby? I don't know yet, but I'll work something out. You know what? I feel like I need my hair combed some. You want to comb my hair? Yes, she said, and laughed just when he thought she was going to cry. But for the first time, she recognized that they were not two cleaving halves of one person, but two separate people, and that because he was a man, he could leave any time he wanted, and because she was a woman, she could not. The cabin reeked of desertion and betrayal. Archie and Sink. Men raised from infancy with horses could identify salient differences with a glance, but some had a keener talent for understanding equine temperament than others. Sink Gartrell was one of those. Sink gave off a hard air of competence. On Roundup, the elegant Brit remittance man Morton Frewin had once noticed him handling a nervous cloud watcher horse and remarked that the rider had divine hands. The adjective set the cowhands guffawing and imitating Freeman's stuffed-nosed accent for a few days. Sink thought the new kid might make a top hand with horses if he got over being a show-off. The second or third morning after he joined the roundup, Archie had wakened early, sat up in his bedroll while Cookie Hell was stoking the fire, and let loose a getting-up holler decorated with some rattlesnake yodels, startling old Hell who dropped the coffee pot in the fire and earning curses from the scattered bedrolls. Foreman Alonzo Lago, who had barely noticed him before, stared hard at the curly-haired new hand who'd made all the noise. Sink noticed him looking. Later, Sink took the kid aside and put the boo on him, told him the facts of life, and said that old Lon would bull him good if ever he agreed to get into a bedroll with him, said that the leathery old foreman was well known for bareback riding of new young hires. Archie, who'd seen it all at Peck's bunkhouse, gave him a look as though he suspected Sink of the same base design and said he could take care of himself. If anyone tried anything on him, he'd clean his plow good, and he moved off. For Archie, the work was the usual ranch hand's luck, hard, dirty, long, and dull. There was no time for anything but saddle up, ride, rope, cut, herd, unsaddle, eat, sleep, and do it again. On the clear, dry nights, coyote voices seemed to emanate from a single point in straight lines, the calls crisscrossing like taut wires. When cloud cover moved in, the howls spread out in a different geometry, overlapping like concentric circles from a handful of pebbles thrown into water. But most often, the wind surging over the plain sanded the cries into a kind of coyote dust, fractioned into particles of sound. He longed to be back on his own sweet place, fencing his horse pastures, happy with Rose. He thought about the coming child, imagined a boy half grown, and helping him build wild horse traps in the desert, capturing the Mustangs. He could not quite conjure up a baby. As late summer folded, Sink saw that Archie sat straight up in the saddle and was quiet and even tempered and good with horses. The kid was one of the kind horses liked, calm and steady. No more morning hollers, and the only songs he sang were after supper when somebody else started one. He kept to himself pretty much, often staring into the distance, but every man had something of value beyond the horizon. Despite his ease with horses, he'd been bucked off an oily bronc ruined beyond redemption by the Montana horsebreaker Wally Finch, and instinctively putting out one hand to break his fall, snapped his wrist, and spent weeks with his arms strapped to his body, rode and did everything else one-handed. "Kid, there's a way to fall so you don't get hurt," said Sink. "You fold your arms, see? You get one shoulder up and your head down. You give a little twist while you're falling so you hit the ground with your shoulder. You just roll right on over and onto your feet." He didn't know why he was telling him this, and he crouched up. "Hell, figure it out yourself." Rose and the Coyotes. July was hot, the air vibrating, the dry land like a scraped sheep hoof. The sun drew the color from everything, and the little weed trickled through dull stones. In a month, not even that trickle would be dried. Even that trickle would be dried by the hot river rocks, the grass parched white, creatures praying for rain. Rose could not sleep in the cabin, which was as hot as the inside of a black hat box. She woke one morning exhausted and sweaty and went down to the little weed, hoping for night-cooled water. There was a dark cloud to the south, and she was glad to hear the distant rumble of thunder. In anticipation, she set out the big kettle and two buckets to catch rainwater. The advance wind came in, thrashing tree branches, ripping leaves. The grass went sidewise. Lightning danced on the crest of Barrel Mountain, and then a burst of hail swallowed up the landscape in a chattering, roaring sweep. The rocks disappeared in the river in the foam of rising water. Her buckets were full of sweet water and floating hailstones. She stripped and poured dippers of goosebump water over her head again and again until one bucket was nearly empty and she was shaking. The air was as cool and fresh as September, the heat broken. The next morning, it was cold and sleety and her back ached. She wished for the heat of summer to return. She staggered when she walked, and it didn't seem worthwhile to make coffee. She drank water and stared at the icy spicule sliding down the window glass. Around mid-morning, the backache increased, working itself into a slow rhythm. It dawned on her very slowly that the baby was not waiting for September. By afternoon, the backache was an encircling python, and she could do nothing but pant and whimper, the steady rattle of rain dampening her moaning call for succor. She wriggled out of her heavy dress and put on her oldest nightgown. The pain increased to waves of cramping agony that left her gasping for breath on and on, the day fading into night, the rain torn away by wind, dark, choking hours eternal. Another dawn came sticky with the return of heat, and still her raw loins could not deliver the child. On the fourth afternoon, voiceless from calling for Archie, her mother, Tom Ackler's cat, from screaming imprecations at all of them, at God, at any God, then at the river ducks and the weasel, to any entity that might hear, the python relaxed its grip and slid off the bloody bed, leaving her spiraling down in plum-colored mist. It seemed late afternoon. She was glued to the bed and at the slightest movement felt a hot surge that she knew was blood. She got up on her elbows and saw the clotted child, stiff and gray, the barley rope cord and the afterbirth. She did not weep, but filled with an ancient rage, got away from the tiny corpse, knelt on the floor, ignoring the hot blood seeping from her, and rolled the infant up in the stiffening sheet. It was a bulky mass, and she felt the loss of the sheet as another tragedy. When she tried to stand, the blood poured, but she was driven to bury the child, to end the horror of the event. She crept to the cupboard, got a dish towel, and rewrapped him in a smaller bundle. Her hand closed on the silver spoon, her mother's wedding present, and she thrust it into the placket neck of her nightgown, the cool metal-like bomb. Clenching the knot of the dish towel in her teeth, she crawled out the door and toward the sandy soil near the river, where, still on hands and knees, still spouting blood, she dug a shallow hole with a silver spoon and laid the child in it, heaping it with sand and piling on whatever river stones were within reach. It took more than an hour to follow her blood trail back to the cabin, the twilight deep by the time she reached the doorstep. The bloody sheet lay bunched on the floor, and the bare mattress showed a black stain like the map of South America. She lay on the floor, for the bed was miles away, a cliff only birds could reach. Everything seemed to swell and shrink, the twitching bed leg, a damp clout swooning over the edge of the dishpan, the wall itself bulging forward, the chair flying viciously, all pulsing with the rhythm of her hot, pumping blood. Barrel Mountain, bringing darkness, squashed its bulk against the window, and owls crashed through, wings like iron bars. Struggling through the syrup of subconsciousness in the last hour, she heard the coyotes outside and knew what they were doing. As the September nights cooled, Archie got nervous and went into town as often as he could, called at the post office, but no one saw him come out with any letters or packages. Alonzo Lago sent Sink and Archie to look for some distant, to check some distant draws, ostensibly for old renegade cows too wily or a few mavericks too young to be caught in any roundup. "Well, what's eating you?" said Sink as they rode out, but the kid shook his head. Half an hour later, he opened his mouth as if he were going to say something and looked away from Sink and gave a half shrug. "You got something you want to say?" said Sink. "Christ's sake, say it. I got my head on backwards or what? You didn't know he was going to smudge brands? You going to get all holy about it, are you?" Archie looked around. "I'm married," he said. "She is having a baby pretty soon." "Well, I'm damned. How old are you?" 17. "Old enough to do what's got to be did. Anyway, how old are you?" 32. "Old enough to be your daddy." There was a half-hour silence, and then Sink started again. "You know old Carrick don't keep married fellers. He finds out, he'll fire you." "Well, I ain't going to find out from me. It's more money than I can get on the little weed, but I got to find a way to that Rose can let me know about things." "Well, I ain't no wet nurse. I know that. Long as you know it." Damn fool kid, he thought, his life already too complicated to live, and said aloud, "Me, I would never get hitched an old fell on a hatchet female." The next week, half the crew went into town, and Archie spent an hour on the bench outside the post office writing on some brown wrapping paper, addressed the tortured missive to Rose at the stage station where he believed her to be. "What about the baby?" he wrote. "Is he born?" But inside the post office, the wall-eyed clerk with fingernails like yellow chisels told him the postage had gone up. "First time in 100 years. Cost you 2 cents to send a letter now," he smirked with satisfaction. Archie, who had only 1 cent, tore up his letter and threw the pieces in the street. The wind dealt them to the prairie, its chill promising a tight, clenched winter. Rose's parents, the Mealers, moved to Omaha in November, seeking a cure for Mrs. Mealer's declining health. "You think you can stay sober long enough to ride down and let Rosie and Archie know we're going?" the sick woman whispered to Sundown. "Why, I'm going right now, as soon as I find my other boot. Just you don't worry, I got it covered." A full bottle of whiskey took him as far as the river crossing. Dazedly drunk, he rode to the little cabin on the river but found the place silent. The door closed. Swaying, feeling the landscape slide around, he called out 3 or 4 times, but was unable to get off his horse. Knew well enough if he did, he could never get back on. "They're not there," he reported to his wife. "Not there." "Well, where could they be? Did you put a note on the table?" "Didn't think of it. Anyway, not there." "I'll write her from Omaha," she whispered. Within a week of their departure, a replacement freighter arrived, Buck Roy with his heavy-set wife and a raft of children. The Mealers, who had failed even to be buried in the stage station cemetery, were forgotten. Carrick's cows. December was miserable, one storm after another bouncing in like a handful of hurled poker chips, and January turned cold enough to freeze flying birds dead. Foreman Alonzo Lago sent Archie out to gather any bovine wonders he could find in a certain washout area, swampy in June, but now hundreds of deep holes and snaky little streams smoothly covered with snow. "Keep your eye peeled for any wing-crossed leather pounders. You better take some sticks and a cinch wing." So Archie knew he was looking for wing cross cows to doctor their brands, but the wing cross had its own little ways with brand reworking, so he guessed it was more or less an even exchange. I'm going to skip a bunch, or we won't get there. All right. He goes out after the cows and comes back. He's okay. The weather was changing. When he reached the bunkhouse 4 hours after dark, the thermometer had fallen to zero. His boots were frozen and chilled to the liver. He fell asleep without eating or undressing beyond his boots. "You get back and get them cows," hissed Alonzo Lago 2 hours later, leaning over his face. "You get up and on it right now. Mr. Carrick wants them cows." "Goddamn short nights on this goddamn ranch," muttered Archie, pulling on his wet boots. Back in the swamp, it was just coming light, like gray polish on the cold world, the air so still Archie could see the tiny breath cloud of a finch on a willow twig. Beneath the hardened crust, the snow was wallowy. The fresh horse was Poco, who did not know swamps. Poco blundered along, stumbled into an invisible sinkhole, and took Archie down with him. The snow shot down his neck, up his sleeves, into his boots, filled eyes, ears, nose, matted his hair. Poco, in getting up, rammed his hat deep into the bog. The snow, in contact with his body heat, melted, and as he climbed back into the saddle, the wind that accompanied the pale sunlight froze his clothes. Somehow he managed to push 8 wing-cross strays out of the swamp and back toward the high ground, but his matches would not light, and while he struggled to make a fire, the cows scattered. He could barely move, and when he got back to the bunkhouse, he was frozen into the saddle and had to be pried off the horse by 2 men. He heard cloth rip. The next morning when Archie tried to get up, he was overcome by dizziness. Boiling heat surged through him. His cheeks flamed red. His hands burned with high fever, and he had a dry, constant cough. His headache, the bunkhouse, slopped back and forth as if on rockers. He could not stand, and he breathed with a sound like a blacksmith's bellows. Sink looked at him and thought, pneumonia. "You look pretty bad. I'll go see what Carrick says." When he came back half an hour later, Archie was burning. "Carrick says to get you out of here, but the bastard won't let me take the wagon. He says he's got a cancer in his leg and he needs the wagon for himself to have the doc at the fort cut it out. Lon's fixing up a kind of a travoy. His ma had some Indian kin, so he knows how to do it. Sometimes he ain't so bad. We'll get you down to Cheyenne and you can ride the train where your mother is." We're not going to make it, folks. Okay. If Michael comes with the big hook, oh, okay. Okay, good. The big hook's there. Okay, and Carrick says you were fired. I had to tell him you was married, so he let you get loose. He was all set to have you die in the bunkhouse. We'll get a doc and beat this down. It's only pneumonia. I had it twice. Archie tried to say his mother was long gone. He needed to get to Rose down on the Little Weed. Tried to say that it was 60-odd miles from Rawlins to their cabin, but he couldn't get a word out because of the wheezing, breath-sucking cough. Sink shook his head, got some biscuits and bacon from the cook. Sink wrapped the legs of a horse named Preacher in burlap to keep the crust from cutting them, lashed the travoy poles to his saddle, a tricky business to get the balance right. The small ends projected beyond the horse's ears, but the foreman said that was to accommodate wear on the drag ends. They rolled Archie in his bedroll in a buffalo robe, and Sink began to drag him to Cheyenne, 100 miles south. The wind, which had dropped a little overnight, came up, pushing a lofty bank of cloud. After 4 hours, they had covered 9 miles. The snow began, increasing in intensity until they were traveling blind. "Kid, I can't see nothing," called Sink. He stopped and dismounted and went to Archie. The earlier snow had melted as fast as it touched that red, feverish face, but gradually, just a fraction of an inch above the surface of the hot flesh, a mask of ice now formed a gray glaze. "Better hole up. There's a line shack somewhere's around here. Could we find it? I was there all summer a couple years back, down a little from the top of a hogback." The horse, Preacher, had also spent the summer at the line camp, and he went straight to it now. It was on the lee side of a hogback, a little below the crest. The wind had dumped an immense amount of snow on the tiny cabin, but Sink found the door to the lean-to entry, and that would do to shelter the horse. He wrestled Archie inside and got him and the buffalo robe onto the plank bunk, and then put the stovepipe together and jammed it up through the roof hole. Neither inside nor in the entryway could he see any chunk wood, but he remembered where the old chip pile had been, and using the broken shovel, scraped up enough snow-welded chips to get the fire going. While the chips went steaming and sizzling in the stove, he unsaddled Preacher, removed the gunny sacks from his legs, and rubbed the horse down. He checked the lean-to shallow loft, hoping for hay, but there was nothing. "Well, goddamn," he said, and tore some of the loft floorboards loose to burn in the stove. Back outside, he dug through the snow with a broken shovel until he hit ground, got out his knife and sawed off the sun-cured grass until he had two or three hatfuls. "Best I can do," he said, tossing it down for the horse. It was almost warm inside the shack. From his saddlebag, he took a small handful of the coffee beans he always carried. The old coffee grinder was still on the wall, but a mouse had built a nest in it, and he had no way to unbolt the machine to clean it out. Unwilling to drink boiled mouse shit, he crushed the beans on the table with the flat of his knife. He looked around for the coffee pot that belonged to the cabin, but did not see it. There was a 5-gallon coal oil tin near the bunk. He sniffed at it, but could detect no noisome odors, packed it with snow, and put it on the stove to melt. It was while he was scraping up snow outside that the edge of the coal oil can hit the coffee pot. That, too, he packed with snow. It looked to him as though the last occupant of the shack had been someone with a grudge, showing his hatred of Carrick by throwing coffee pots and burning all the wood. Maybe a Wing Cross rider. The coffee was hot and black, but when he brought the cup to Archie, the kid swallowed one mouthful, then coughed and finally puked it up. Sink drank the rest himself and ate one of the biscuits. It was a bad night. The bunk was too narrow and the kid so hot and twitchy that Sink swooned in and out of 40 wink snaps of sleep. Finally got up and slept in the chair with his head on the table. A serious blizzard and fatal cold began to slide down from the Canadian plains that night, and when it broke 12 days later, the herds were decimated, cows packed 10 deep against barbed wire fences, pronghorn congealed into statues, trains stalled for 3 weeks by 40-foot drifts, and 2 cowpunchers in a line shack frozen together in a buffalo robe. It was May before Tom Ackler rode up from Taos, where he had spent the fall and winter. Despite the beating sunshine, the snow was still deep around his cabin. Patches of bare ground showed bright green with a host of thrusting thistles. He wondered if gold dust had made it through. He could see no cat tracks. He lit a fire using an old newspaper on the table, and just before the flame swallowed it, glimpsed a few penciled words and the signature Archie. "All lost, whatever it was. I'll go down tomorrow and see how they're doing." In the morning, Goldust pranced out of the trees, her coat thick. Tom let her in and threw her a choice piece of bacon. "Look like you kept pretty good," he said. But the cat sniffed at the bacon, went to the door, and when he opened it, returned to the woods. "Probably shacked up with a bobcat," he said. Around noon, he saddled the horse and headed for the McLaverty cabin. No smoke rose from the chimney. A slope of snow lay against the woodpile. He noticed that very little wood had been burned. The weasel's tracks were everywhere, right up into the eaves. Clear enough, the weasel had gotten inside. As he squinted at the tracks, the weasel suddenly squirted out of a hole in the eaves and looked at him. It was the largest, handsomest weasel he had ever seen, shining eyes, lustrous coat. He thought of his cat, and it came to him that wild creatures managed well enough through the winter. He wondered if gold dust could breed with a bobcat and recalled then that Rose had been expecting. Must be they went to the station. But he opened the door and looked inside, calling, "Rose? Archie?" What he found sent him galloping for the stage station. At the station, everything was in an uproar, all of them standing in the dusty road in front of the Dorgan's house, Mrs. Dorgan crying, Quita with her mouth agape, and Robert F. Dorgan shouting at his wife, accusing her of betraying him with a human wreck. They paid little attention to Tom Ackler when he slid in on his lathered horse, calling that Rose McLaverty was raped and murdered and mutilated by Utes sometime in the winter, God knew when. Only Mrs. Buck Roy, the new freighter's wife, who was terrified of Indians, gave him much attention. The Dorgans continued to scream at each other. The more urgent event to them was the suicide that morning of the old bachelor telegraph operator who had swallowed lie after weeks of scribbling a 400-page letter addressed to Robert Dorgan and outlining his hopeless adoration of Mrs. Dorgan, the wadded pages fulsomely riddled with references to ivory thighs, the Adam and Eve dance, her secret slit, and the like. What Tom Ackler had thought was an old saddle and a pile of grain sacks on the porch was the corpse. "Where there's smoke, there's fire," bellowed Robert F. Dorgan. "I took you out of that Omaha cat house and made you a decent woman, give you everything, and here's how you reward me, you dripping bitch. How many times you snuck over there? How many times you took his warty old cock?" I didn't. That filthy old brute," sobbed Mrs. Dorgan, suffused with rage that the vile man had fastened his attentions on her, had dared to write down his lascivious thoughts as real events, putting in the details of her pink-threaded camisole, the red mole on her left buttock, and finally vomiting black blood all over the telegraph shack and the front porch of the Dorgan's house where he had dragged himself to die, the 400-page bundle of lies stuffed in his shirt. For years, she had struggled to make herself a genteel specimen of womanhood, grateful that Robert F. Dorgan had saved her from economic sexuality and determined to erase that past. Now, if Dorgan forced her away, she would have to go back on the game, for she could think of no other way to make a living. And maybe Quida, too, whom she had brought up as a lady. Her sense of personal worth faltered and then flared up as if doused with kerosene. "Why, you dirty old rumneck," she said in a hoarse voice. "What give you the idea you got a right to a beautiful wife and daughter? What give you the idea we would stay with you? Look at you. You want to be territory surveyor, but without me and Quida to talk up the important political men, you couldn't catch a cold." Dorgan knew it was true and gnawed at his untrimmed mustache. He turned and melodramatically strode into the house, slamming the door so hard the report killed mice. Mrs. Dorgan had won, and she followed him in for a reconciliation. Tom Ackler looked at Quida, who was tracing an arc in the dirt with the toe of her kid leather boot. They heard the rattle of a stove lid inside the house, Mrs. Dorgan making up a fire to warm the bedroom. "Rose McLaverty," he said, but Quida shrugged. A tongue of wind lapped the dust, creating a miniature whirl as perfect in shape as any tornado snaking down from black clouds. The dust devil collapsed and died. Quida turned away, walked around the shaded back of the Dorgan house. Tom Ackler stood holding the reins, then remounted and started back, the horse moving in a kind of equine stroll. On the way, he thought of the whiskey in his cupboard and then of Rose, decided he would get drunk that night and bury her the next day. It was the best he could do for her. He thought, too, that perhaps it hadn't been Utes who killed her, but her young husband, berserk and raving, and now fled to distant ports. He remembered the burned newspaper with Archie's message consumed before it could be read, and thought it unlikely if Archie had killed his young wife in a frenzy that he would stop by a neighbor's place and leave a signed note, unless it was maybe a confession. There was no way now to know what had happened. The more he thought about Archie, the more he remembered the clear, hard voice and the singing. He thought about Gold Dust's rampant vigor and rich fur, about the sleek weasel at the McLaverty cabin. Some lived and some died, and that's how it was. He buried Rose in front of the cabin and for a tombstone wrestled the big sandstone rock Archie had hauled in for a doorstep upright. He wanted to chisel her name, but put it off until the snow started. It was too late then, time for him to head for Taos. The following spring, as he rode past their cabin, he saw that frost heaves had tipped the stone over and that the ridgepole of the roof had broken under a heavy weight of snow. He rode on, singing, "When the green grass comes and the wild rose blooms," one of Archie's songs, wondering if Gold Dust had made it through again. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I feel like we should have some music.
Okay. Well, I think that a marathon feat like that deserves another round of applause.
No. Thank you.
Now, everything that can happen happens in this story. And, you know, sadness is cheek by jowl with comedy. And there are certain cases, like the detail of the coffee grinder that a mouse has made a nest in, is in equal parts disgust and comedy. I wondered to begin with about the creation of the mix of life in a single short story.
That's a terribly hard question to answer. I don't know exactly how it sorts out, but to me life is handfuls of both. And it seems wrong to leave any of the funny stuff or the sad stuff out. How many times in the middle of weeping or crying have we started to laugh about something? I mean, that's how it is. Loss is interrupted by gain, pain by the long view and seeing ourselves as insignificant, and therefore our grief is insignificant. So it just seems like a natural thing to do to me, to mix those things up. And as for the measuring of how much you put in of what, I don't know. I think it's a seat of the pants thing.
I think so too. But I think when I think about it, how many books come out that are only funny or only austere, I remember that your first novel was published when you were in your 50s mm-hmm. already, and that the ability to know both seemed to me to be the result of having lived, that a novel to be extraordinary has to know that life is various and variously unrelenting.
I think, at least for me, it was good to have waited to start writing until I was at a point in life where most people would say, this is ridiculous, go do something else, you know, go bake cakes. But I had a lifetime of reading and a lifetime of life behind me. I mean, books have been with me since I was very, very young. I think I learned to read when I was around 4, and for me it was wonderful. Talking with our mutual friend Paul at the New York Public Library early last month, everyone on this little panel had to discuss a book that had changed their life in some way, and everybody had grand books. Books of importance by famous authors and so forth, except me. I had a bad book, but it really did change my life. When I was 7 years old, I read Before Adam by Jack London, not one of his best books. It was about prehistoric creatures who were not quite men. And it was social Darwinism at its most frightful. And it had gripping characters, the protagonist's friend Lop-Ear and a perfectly dreadful fellow named Red-Eye, who seized all of the women and carried them off to his lair, and then when he tired of them, threw them away or broke their necks. And at the age of 7... It was kind of strong medicine, but the thing that the book really did for me, because I had, since the time I was really little, asked where do people come from, you know, where do ants come from? I really wanted to know, and no adults had any answers. But all of a sudden, with this book, I realized that there was an enormous world out there filled with books, and I could find these things out. I had never heard of prehistoric people before, and so for me, Before Adam was a great book, and it stayed that way for a few years.
Well, speaking of Jack London, it leads me to be aware of the extraordinary wealth of natural writing of his time. When you read The Call of the Wild, you mm-hmm. are unforgettably near that fire in that icy environment, mm-hmm. hearing those dogs. And it seems to me that although it may sound sneering to us now, there was a school of writing called local colorist, mm-hmm. and it included Hamlin Garland,
yes.
and it included a great number of writers who were recognizing that right next to the glory of the natural world, was the terror of frail existence. The stories would have titles like Under the Lion's Claw, that we would know that we lived in the midst of a natural beauty that would kill us.
And all of the prairie writers too, Rolvag and Willa Cather and all, these are wonderful books. I mean, they are still so worth reading with a kind of power that is missing from a great deal of writing today, and the power is there because the natural world is there. And a lot of people are just beginning to realize that the natural world is still there and still powerful.
Yes, one of the great beauties, because as these writers, some of them would write books for children. Hamlin Garland wrote a book called A Boy's Life on the Prairie. Those mm-hmm. of you who know it was used as an epigraph for the film Days of Heaven. Terrence Malick used it. But you see, it seems to me that city writing obliterated the sense of a world in which you could be by mm-hmm. nature so alone that just living would extinguish you. Mm-hmm. And that we lost a sense of destiny as writing moved to cities and the danger to humans came from other humans.
I think that's quite correct. I don't think anybody's really examined this thoroughly, the difference when people began making the big shift to the cities after the First World War. Everybody was thinking urban and town, and then after the Second World War it was suburban. And away it all went, that close to the wild and dangerous and hard, unforgiving world where if you make a mistake it can indeed be your last. One thing about Wyoming that I really like is that it has a little saying about itself that says, the way America was. And that's very real. That's true. It is the way America was. And there are still plenty of dangerous situations you can get into. And I think that's one of the reasons that I've done these three volumes of stories on the place, because place, the geography, the stories that are connected to land and sky are just so overwhelming. They're there, and how can you avoid them?
Well, one of the things that I love most about those three books of stories is that they range from stories of enormous intensity, like the story you just heard, which is coming out in just fine the way it is in October, to stories that are almost like throwaway stories, stories in which the devil, looking up at the earth, says the earth has become such a good hell that he better work pretty hard to redesign hell and do some upgrading, because the people getting there are not going to be impressed. almost as if we have to remember that folklore makes a joke out of the same terrors that go into these stories of extinguishment.
I think it's difficult sometimes to tell when something stops being funny and becomes painful and the other way around. And I like to get close to that edge, personally. And I think readers do, too. I think there's a kind of frisson that makes for a good reading experience. Though I have to say, the devil stories, I don't write for the reader so much as, you're right, they are throwaway stories. We were talking earlier about the murder mystery things that I've forgotten who was writing, and felt great pleasure and relief at writing something that wasn't difficult.
John Banville.
Yeah, yes.
He's writing under the name Benjamin Black, and he said to me, I can write 10 pages of this stuff a day. It used to be a single paragraph would take me a whole day. As Benjamin Black, I can write nonstop and not be flummoxed.
So the devil stories, of which there are a couple in this last collection, are for me for fun. And I don't know why I find the devil to be an amusing character. It's that edge thing again, because the devil's not very funny.
Well, what strikes me as being particularly interesting here, that play, again, story next to story, reading a book where one story is hilarious and the next story is, you know, dark with the hilarity, glints like mica chips in the darkness of the story. That writing needs its variousness, and in fact, that most stories are variants of one another. After I had read the story you just heard, I realized it contains the same ingredients as Brokeback Mountain. A man leaving home joins another man, they end up in a buffalo robe together. The woman abandoned, the parents going off, you know, into the distance of indifference, just going away. And yet, look how different these stories are, made out of what one might say are the same skeleton. I wondered, you know, because I know you read folklore, and so much folklore is based upon knowing what a single difference will do to a story.
This is going to take us directly toward the Arabian Nights. It has to. That great, fantastic, bizarre, funny, sad, wrenching, impossible fate stamped on the forehead net of stories that underlies literature vastly. And many writers are much intrigued by it. An Australian writer friend of mine, David Foster, just spent 3 months in the Australian National Library, and he spent every single minute of the time he was there reading Burton's overwrought and superheated translation in 17 volumes of the Arabian Nights.
With notes.
Yes, the notes are apparently quite self-serving, and they started a cascade of notes to every edition of Arabian Nights, I guess, except the Hadawi, which I haven't read. I have not read the Burton, and I probably never will in my life. But the idea that these stories, who knows how old these stories are? I think they've traced it back. There was a fragment that dates from the 9th century that just has the beginning where Scheherazade comes to the king, and it's just one page, but it's the 9th century, and who knows how old these stories are. They may go back to the time when we all sat around flickering fires. And I just really am entranced by the idea that this huge, massive collection of stories are there, and yet there are such powerful similarities in the stories. There are patterns there, and it's impossible, I think, not to get into them. And if that's my situation, I'm not aware of it, but I certainly agree that it's quite possible that that I have a particular pattern of story that that I keep falling into.
It's, I think, the nature of stories to, because what we hear in the Arabian Nights, let's remember, 1,001 nights, that's nearly 3 years during which the princess Scheherazade puts the sultan to sleep by beginning a story that, if he doesn't like, he promises to kill her. And she has to tell a story good enough. Now, it's said that 2 years into the process of telling the stories, she had a child. And not only did she have a child, but her kid sister, Dunyazad, was sitting at the foot of the bed to say, "Oh, the Scheherazade, I hear the cock crowing. It's time for us all to go to bed. This is a wonderful story. I hope you'll continue it tomorrow." Right. And the Sultan would say, "Yes, do that, Scheherazade." And gradually...
But that sister is so wonderful. I really like the sister. And John Barth played with the Arabian Nights fantastically. I mean, he just... I can't remember what he called Dunny and
Dooney. Dooney and Sherry.
Yes. but the Arabian Nights is a great pleasure, and we can't escape it. It's
But I've wondered whether you feel like Scheherazade, telling us stories to remind us as a culture, not that that we only have one more day to stay alive, and that we may be extinguishing ourselves.
No. No.
Damn!
The thought is certainly there, but I think I'm probably more hopeful. It's, again, to go back to Gass and the Pedersen kid when he says, "Anything can happen." The first time I read that sentence, it was as though someone had taken a tattoo needle and just drawn it across my chest. Anything can happen. And it seemed like anything should and could happen in stories. And for me, that suddenly became the key to a story. Anything can happen.
That's William Gass, and the novella is The Pedersen Kid. It's in a book of stories called In the Heart of the Heart of the Country, and it's absolutely unforgettable. And those people, you see, I think that people make a terrible mistake. I find that Annie Proulx writes art stories of the sort that William Gass writes, but as soon as you become funny, and as soon as you start, how do I put it, genuinely attracting an audience, the literary critic types want to say, "Oh, this is no longer art, it's too popular." And I think that this is to the great destruction of contemporary literature, because some of our best writers are popular. We're secretly living in a very good time with writers who fill entire theaters. How do you feel about popularity as it's come to you?
Oh, it's strange. It's strange. I'm basically a very retiring, rather quiet but single-minded kind of person, and I don't speak easily. That's why I'm a writer. It's difficult for me to be popular, and it seems to me very often that someone's made a mistake.
Now, there's a point where you absolutely set out to make language sing and yodel and do all sorts of new things. The earlier book, The Great Shipping News, had been written in sentence fragments, but suddenly Accordion Crimes was written in beautiful, long, musical, almost unbelievably colorful sentences where sound really is dominant and seems to me the furthest move so far from the prose of historian. And it's Joycean prose. You know, it's the prose that wants to do everything that words can do and to stretch its muscles and absolutely howl. How did that come for you?
That book was a failure for me, because what I wanted to do, it looks at nine different immigrant groups, I think nine, maybe seven, maybe 11.
Nine.
And I wanted to somehow get the rhythm of each of these groups' home music into the section on them, and I couldn't do it. And so I had to settle for something lesser. I mean, it was in my head, but I couldn't make it work on the page. I just couldn't do it. And I don't know, maybe someday I'll try it again secretly and see if I've learned anything. But it was a great pleasure to work on that book. I got to meet some of the most interesting people anywhere, accordion menders, makers, musicians. It was a grand time working on that book.
Many of the people in your family have been musicians and sound technicians, and it's very interesting. Because your mother was a painter, but after you seem to have brought music into the lives of your children.
Well, they brought music into my life. I have four children, and three of them are intensely musical and play instruments and have in their lives done the music thing. So I've gotten a lot from them, but I am also entranced by music, and when I was a kid, played the violin and listened a lot to music. I have always loved music in all of its forms except rap. It's the one kind of music I don't really enjoy. But everything else is grist for the mill. I mean, you can get carried away by Sufi chants and opera. Just think, it's like the stories. It's all out there. Just give me it. It's part of this very rich life. How lucky we are to live in a time when so many things are available to taste and appreciate and sample and read and listen to. It's a good time to be alive.
I'm curious, because one of the things that used to scare me about poetry when I try to read it was how many flowers and plants and animals a poet would see and describe. This is no longer true of modern poetry, by and large, often as not. And I don't know, when I read the old poetry, what the flowers looked like. I had to start going out to the desert to look at winter weeds and get a sense. It's almost as if the world that was written about is harder to read because we don't look at the same things anymore.
Indeed, the sky itself is harder to read for people who don't, who aren't familiar with cloud forms and wind shapes and coming weather. If you don't use it, you lose it. These were important things in our past, and they're not anymore. It's all done for us by specialists and conveyed to us by little televisions that sets in the back of a taxi seat. I don't think they have those here. But in New York, if you climb into a cab, the news is in front of your face constantly as you go along.
But how do you... You've taught yourself the natural world.
I grew up with a rural family. I've always lived in rural situations, except for a very few years of my life. I lived a year in Tokyo, and I lived a year in New York City. And that's my urban experience. The rest of the time, and I spent the winter in Santa Fe. And that's about the extent of my urban experience. So,
well, you've told me that you've lived in towns that have less than 100 population.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so just explain to me. You go outside and you see something new. You don't know the name for it, but what if no one else does either? You're in a town with a population of 20. How do you find the words for the world?
Well, this brings us right back to the Jack London book, Before Adam. I discovered that there are ways to find out without asking other people, and those are books. And that's why I have a house that is that was built to hold books, and the books are there now. So I can find out what it's called, but that's not the main point about a plant that I don't know. The main thing, and the same with birds that I don't know, is what kind of habitat does it need? How does it interact with other plants? What does it mean to what's around it? What eats it? What doesn't eat it? What its character is? And the same thing with birds. Bird behavior interests me very much. I was so disappointed when I want to say Michael Cunningham, but it isn't Michael Cunningham. Someone who wrote a wonderful book about his...
Oh, yes. Jonathan... Franzen. Franzen.
Yes. And he got into a bird-watching frenzy, where he had to note them all down, all the birds that he'd seen. He made, you know, the life list. And that's all he did for several years, and he was fanatic about it with splendid binoculars and a telescope and so forth. And then when he reached, I forgot what it was, 1001, he put the whole thing away and was done. The list was finished and went on to something else, because it was just getting the name of a bird. If you see the bird and you write the name down, you've done it. You've done that bird. It's over. And I was just heartbroken when he did that, because that's not the interesting thing about birds. The interesting thing is what they do and how they regard us. And do birds recognize you if you appear in a certain place every day? Do they always flee when you come into sight? And if so, why? You know, this kind of thing is interesting to me, the way it all plugs in together. So I guess I'm holistic in mind, in a sense.
Well, I'm the beneficiary of that interest. Even as we talked together, we were upstairs. The floor was painted green. One said, well, maybe it adds texture to the floor. There are dancers around here, and you don't want them to slip and slide. And Annie Proust said, well, there's sand that you can put in paint, and it makes it absolutely, the friction is there. Yes, when we read a great writer, we learn about the world, and she returns us not just to the world itself, but to the books about the world, not just to the stories, but to the histories from which the stories derive, and the mythology, And, you know, when I imagine Annie Proulx walking, I imagine, like the story, the man singing as he goes over his land, knowing it, that landscape is story. And if you will talk a little bit about that, we will thank you and then say goodnight.
Earlier, some of us were talking about landscape as story, geography as story. And for me, the way I begin writing everything is with understanding as much as I can about geology, geography, the climate, the direction the wind blows in a particular place, how people make their living there, what comes from the world around them that makes them behave the way they do. And I don't start with a story in mind, really. Sometimes the story that I read tonight started with only two things, some of the names of the old cowboy songs, which I find very interesting and beautiful, and the old whiskey names, too. My mother used to collect bottles, and some of those bottles were whiskey bottles. And whiskey bottles used to have cool names, you know, that you Daydream and GG Booze, which is where we get the booze. So that was where that particular story came from, wanting to write a story that involved old whiskey bottles and old cowboy songs, even in a minor capacity. But this thing about story being related to place to me is immense. And we were talking earlier, some of us, about song lines, Chatwin's song lines that came out of the Aboriginal identification of place in the outback through songs that were sung. The journey was the song. And you can do that with a story. A story is the place, too. You can find your way if you have stories that fasten themselves or that come out of the landscape, particular mesas, rocks with odd shape that resemble a bird, or in the mid-19th century, a steamboat. And if you do live in the country, and I'm sure every person in this room has been out in beautiful New Mexico and has seen certain rocks, not necessarily Camel Rock, but many others that that are clearly place rocks that speak to you, that have something to say, and that that carry inside them stories. I'm sure that going past some of these rocks, you think certain things, and you maybe think the same thing the next time you go past it, whether it's the color of shadow or something that happened or something that you wished might happen. The stories are out there. Hello.
Yes, there they are. Those are the new stories that are out there.
The new landmarks.
The new bird cries.
Oh, that's not funny. I had a cell phone that had a bird call, and I was out on an island in the river waiting for a call from my archaeologist friend, and it was springtime. This was a few years ago, and I was busy pulling up weeds of some sort, and I kept hearing this exquisite bird singing. The birds were all around me, and I'm looking for the thing. I could not see it. I've never heard a bird with that particular song before. This is when I was new to the cell phone scene. And finally, after about an hour, it dawned on me when my friend didn't appear that he'd been trying to get in touch. So, yes, another kind of story.
Thank you, Annie, very
well,
much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.